Boker Tov, everybody. It's a Rhyme Tovim for those in Israel. I really want to thank Dr. Kohler. I'll have to thank him now because I won't be here for the end of this year, but I want to thank him for really a wonderful series. It's been very enlightening. I think many people have enjoyed and benefited from it. So I want to thank you, and please God, we look forward to learning with you in the future. I also want to thank the Korbin family who are sponsoring this year, this morning, Ruth and Larry Korbin, in observance of the Yortzeit of Ruth's mother, Ariel, the Friedman, Fredel, Bat Zalman, Yikuti, Elva, Rachel, Larry's brother, Jay Korbin, Yaakov, Aharon, Ben Isser, Bechaya, and Larry's grandfather, Bernard Korbin, Dov Ber, Ben Raphael. May their neshamot have an aliyot, may their memories be for a blessing, and may we be blessed with good health and long life, and thank you very much. And like I always say, Torah, we link on a Yortzeit, we link the temporal life of us human beings with the eternal life of the Jewish people and of God and of Torah. That's always a wonderful way to memorialize and observe a Yortzeit. So thank you very much. And we look forward to another wonderful shir. Thank you very much. Bakasha.
Thank you, Rabbi Kalman. Okay. So this is our last one. I did put the link to the slides in the chat if anyone wants. I'm going to share my screen also. So that's just if you want to download them and play with them, look ahead, things like that. Otherwise, you can follow along on my screen. All right, so we're going to recap what we did much of last week and then move on. So I tried to sketch out a map of some of the ways in which Esther has been reacted to, interpreted in modern times and in ancient times, which those two categories have a lot of overlap. And to my mind, the key interpretive question, sort of at the root of some of the interpretive decisions being made, is the question of whether Esther is in fact somehow qualitatively different from the rest of Tanakh, or is meant to be read in light of the rest of Tanakh. And there's no right or wrong. There probably is a right answer answer to that, but there's no easy way of knowing what the right answer to that is. It's hard to even think of what the arguments would be. So some people might say, well, you know, since Esther is constantly alluding to, let's say, the story of Yosef, doesn't that tell you have to read it in light of Yosef? And that, of course, is one possibility. The other possibility would be that the author meant for you to understand and appreciate the contrast between Yosef and this new story that's being told. So that is to say that this big question, what I sort of labeled here as Roman numeral 1 and 2, Esther is not like the rest of Tanakh, Torah, Israel, God are absent, or Israel is like the rest of Tanakh, Torah, Israel, God are central, is a legitimate interpretive question that people have debated, usually implicitly. I think most people have not articulated the question in those terms, but that is the key question that's been debated for literally millennia. Then we divided those up into different types of responses also. So if Esther is not like the rest of Tanakh, well, one possibility is then that Esther is just not a good book. And we saw the Dead Sea Scrolls. Obviously, to actually reject the book, you need to have a lot of gumption. So the Dead Sea Scrolls, who seem to have rejected Esther, Beitar Zionists in the 30s, who said, okay, Purim is a diaspora holiday, Semel HaYahadut HaGalutit, like that's not for us anymore. We're going to replace it with Yud Aleph Adar for Tel Chai. Other Jews, and we'll come back to this soon, said, well, that's why this book is the best book ever. Diaspora Jews, and of course, this doesn't necessarily mean that they were rejecting God or rejecting Israel, but that they saw in this book a book that was more similar to lives that they were familiar with. Lives in Galut, lives without overt miracles. And so we talked last time about the choice in the synagogue at Dura Europis to put the panel of Esther right next to the Aron Kodesh, like you have the Aron, you have Esther. Dura Europis is off in Syria. Maybe that's has something to do with it, that they saw themselves like, this is our book. And we also talked about the minhag, the development of Purim Sheni, or local Purim celebrations, which developed in dozens and dozens of places over the course of Jewish history and throughout the Jewish world, which again tells us that people saw Purim as the holiday that could most be emulated. In other words, when they had something that happened to their community, it was like Purim. It was not like Pesach. Pesach is something that was a one-time event where God stepped in and sent the 10 makot and then split the sea. That's not what happened in Fez in the Middle Ages. Like they didn't see this as like, oh, another Pesach. They saw it as another Purim, where the people happened to be in the right place at the right time. Some bad results were averted. And so Purim and Megillat Esther were seen as the book that speaks to us most directly. That's in the first big category. In the second big category, if you say, no, Esther really has to be read in light of the rest of Tanakh. So it's true, Torah, Israel, God are not mentioned, but you have to understand that they're supposed to be seen anyway. So we talked about some of the heavy-handed corrections, and we'll come back to that a little later today as well. I just sort of saying like, no, well, you don't see it. Ah, here it is. Like, let's make it clear that's in fact what there ought to be. And then the last possibility is that it's all satire. And we spent a little bit of time on this last week because I think it's really interesting. It's also very prevalent today. So I think it's worth thinking about because it is prevalent. But I think it's also very interesting theoretically to think about because the problem as I tried to articulate last week is that it's actually literally impossible to know when something's satire unless you happen to know. In other words, if it's on the Onion, then you know it's satire because it says on the top of the newspaper that this is a satirical newspaper. But if it doesn't say satire anywhere on the book, then you need to know enough to know whether it's satire or not. And in principle, anything can be read as either serious or satirical, and it would totally reverse the meaning. And there is no answer key here. So I'm sort of reminded of the example of rhetorical questions, where you can take any sentence and read it with a question mark exclamation point at the end, and suddenly instead of a statement of affirmation, it becomes a rhetorical question. And of course, you can do this in a serious way, and sometimes it's right. It's actually supposed to be a rhetorical question. Sometimes it comes across as more humorous. I remember a story that, I don't know if it's true or not, my grandfather, Allah Shalom, told me that the story was that in Volozhin, the food was actually pretty good and the accommodations were pretty good. And remember, this is, you know, Eastern European yeshivot. They're living on donations, and many of them were just really poorly funded. So the students lived a rough life. And someone, according to the story, asked the Nitziv, the Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin, that doesn't seem appropriate that the students have such good food and comfortable beds. After all, the Mishnah Navot says, Kachi Dakar Shel Torah. Right, this is the way of Torah. You have bread and salt, and you have a measure of water. Like that's how you acquire Torah. And then Tziv said, no, you're reading the Mishnah wrong. The Mishnah is supposed to be read like this: Kachi darkasha Torah, pat melach tochal v'mayim shurat tishteh. Like, is this the way of Torah? So, of course, you can do that with literally any sentence, right? And you take any sentence and just put a question mark exclamation point at the end, and suddenly it means exactly the opposite. Because now it's a rhetorical question that says, like, could this possibly be true? And you could take, I'm just looking at the screen. I could take any sentence that's on the screen. So therefore, Esther must be rejected. Therefore, Esther must be rejected? Like, obviously not, right? I mean, it works with literally any sentence. And the same thing is true in principle with any story. So a story could be serious or it could be satire, and it will entirely reverse the meaning of it if you claim it's satirical. But the question is, like, how do you know? Like, how can you know? In an ancient text, there's no punctuation. So how do you know it's a rhetorical question? In a work of literature, if it doesn't say satirical novel at the beginning, then how do you know if it's a satirical novel? Like, how do you know that Swift's novel is satirical and not serious? Well, you have to know. You have to know, you know, what he meant, and you have to know something about him and his age and what his goals were. So this is not to, to dispute the claim that Esther is satire. It's simply to point out that I can't think of any way of verifying that it's satire. Like, it may well be, but I think it's important to say, I said this last week also, that essentially the readers who read the Book of Esther as satire are, and I proud member of the group, but are Zionists who essentially look at the book and say, it's inconceivable that there's a book in Tanakh that doesn't center God, Yerushalayim, Israel. That's not possible. Like, how could there be such a book? Like, what is the rest of Tanakh all about? So there's a line, Shmuel Dov Gotain, who became more famous as a scholar of the Cairo Geniza, but started off as a scholar of Tanakh, in a little book of his, he says, the whole book of Tanakh, when you read it from beginning to end, which is actually something we'll come back to later today, when you read it beginning to end, it's a story of how Bnei Israel became a people, got the land of Israel, left the land of Israel, came back to the land of Israel, were kicked out of the land of Israel, and eventually, the very, very end of Tanakh is they came back to the land of Israel once more. That's the big story of Tanakh. So how could it be that there's a book here that has nothing to do with the land of Israel? Like, that doesn't make any sense. So if you assume that it doesn't make any sense for there to be a book in Tanakh that's not about the land of Israel, then one possibility is the whole thing is a satire of Jews who don't realize that they're making a mistake by living in Shushan. Like, they think that life just goes on here in Shushan, that this is something that's worth celebrating. But in fact, the book is actually mocking Jews like that. I'll say that I'm uncomfortable with it, not only for methodological reasons, like I don't know how to verify it, but also because Jewish tradition has always thought that Mordechai and Esther were good people, not the butt of the joke, who are being satirized in the story. So, you know, I think it just is important to say that this is a really radical rereading of the book to claim it's a satire. You wind up demoting Mordechai and Esther from being like actual Jewish heroes, admittedly in a limited sense, but heroes nonetheless, to being, you know, essentially deluded fools who think that they're doing something worthwhile, but actually are just sort of spinning the wheels in the hamster cage and really should have just gone back to Israel to begin with, and then you wouldn't have to do such things. So that's a pretty dramatic result of taking the book as a satire. But in any event, it is absolutely a legitimate move to make. All I want to do is sort of pick apart why that move is made. Like, what are the assumptions that go into making that move? Okay, so that's basically our recap from last week. And again, we'll come back to some of these things and develop them a little bit more over the course of the rest of our hour together. Okay, now I want to show you two more examples of these dynamics in mostly in modern times. So I want to show you some illustrations, but just a word of background. Illustrated Megillot are a big deal in the last 500 years or so, only in the last 500 years. And of course, I should say that, you know, there are no illustrated Sifrei Torah, right? So illustrated Kitvei HaKodesh is not something that should be taken as like obvious in Jewish tradition. Like, we don't do that, actually. We don't have illustrated versions of Tanakh. Certainly not like things that are otherwise for use liturgically. This is the earliest, well, certainly the earliest dated and possibly the earliest illustrated Megillah. The illustrations are quite beautiful. They're not of the story of Esther. It doesn't actually illustrate the story. There are no scenes here of the story of Esther. This, you can see, is from Tuesday, February 15th, 1564. That's what it's dated. It's now in the Bagrinsky collection in Zurich, which you can see online. So Bagrinsky, in addition to collecting lots of Hebrew manuscripts and other antiquities, also invested in a really beautiful website for his collection. So you can go to the Bagrinsky collection website and see high resolution images of the entire Megillah. So the Megillah is, first of all, our oldest dated illustrated Megillah. It's really beautiful. And it's also written by Stelina Bat HaKatzin, which means that it's written by a woman. You can see the rest of the colophon here, where she actually signs it. So it really interestingly, Stelina is our first known scribe illustrator of Megillat Esther. All right. I'll leave it at that. There's halachic discussions about the propriety of illustrations in a Megillah. Again, in a Sefer Torah, this is obviously not acceptable. I'm not going to go into the halachic issues of why. In Megillat Esther, it's debated whether illustrations are okay. So that's one interesting topic of illustrated Megillah. And then the question of women being sofrot. For Megillat Esther is again something that's discussed in halachic literature. So our first dated illustrated Megillah actually gives us examples of a combination. It's a woman soferet within illustrations. So she's really quite fascinating. This was sold. I, you know, when I was looking for pictures of it, I found that it was sold. It was back in 10 years ago or so, for a mere $602,000, $602,500. So that's how Bogrinsky got it. And these things are sort of amazing. And you know, part of me always wishes that they were in a museum. But at least when you have responsible collectors who make high resolution images of their collections available online, it's easier to live with the fact that this is in someone's private collection in Zurich. A little while later, not much later, we have our first Megillah that's illustrated with scenes of the story itself. So you see here scenes at the top. This is signed by a guy, Moshe Pescarol, who decorated here. This is the party in Perek Aleph. It actually says, actually, let me zoom in. Yeah. Like this is at the top of one of the columns. Gam vashti amalka astamish den ashim. So this is not the text of the Megillah. That's on the bottom you see here. But on the top, there's also the scenes from the Megillah, which he then labeled with, you know, what it is that he's illustrating. So this is all background to what to the topic that the examples I want to give you right now. This is just background in the sense that we have illustrated Megillah. Now, today, I don't know if anyone's ever seen an illustrated Megillah in actual use in a Beit Knesset. I have never seen that. But there is an ongoing tradition of illustrated versions of Esther, not in Megillot. In other words, you have your liturgical Megillah that's there. It looks like a Sefer Torah. And then you have illustrated versions of Esther. And I want to show you two that are relatively recent and I think really interesting in the interpretive choices. So this one is by Gadi Palik, called Purim Spiel. Some of you might know some of his books. It's a really interesting. I don't know anything about him personally, but really interesting art of Jewish art, liturgical art, published in these big, really glossy books. And then this is J.T. Waldman's Megillat Esther. So these are roughly contemporaneous. They're both like, I don't know, 10, 15 years old. But they go in really different directions in terms of their illustrative choices. So this is a page from Pollock's Megillah. I'm not sure that you can make out all the details, but I think you can make out enough. So here you have Mordechai in the bottom left. He looks quite pious. He's sitting in the Beit Knesset. The way the whole book is done is that the scene sort of stays the same throughout the story, but like the characters move around, different things happen. Signs go up and down, people move up and down. So this is Haman's house, this is the palace, and here you have the shul. So you have Mordechai in the bottom of the shul, in his talis and tefillin, studying Torah. You have Esther up in the second floor of demure Tzanua, as the signs are going up, saying that all beautiful women have to come to the king. At Haman's house, you have Haman's daughter who's being sent off by her mother, by Haman, by Zeresh, to the contest. Of course, she's very proud and is convinced she's going to win. And you have a couple of other details, but the illustrations are suffused with sort of traditional Torah. So all Jewish men are always wearing tzitzis, talis and tefillin. In this case, they come to shul. They look more or less like they would look in, you know, like 19th century Europe or so. There's a, you know, lip service paid to the fact that this is Persia. So the king certainly looks like a Persian king. The palace doesn't really look like a Persian palace. I'm not sure what that's supposed to look like. Kind of looks like a train station to me, but I don't know. That's neither here nor there. All right. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, we have Waldman's Megillah, which is illustrated in this very different style, aesthetically, very different style. That's Mordechai, who I suppose is supposed to look like a Persian. He has his goatee. I don't know why exactly a goatee, but he has a goatee. Of course, he's bareheaded. He's bare chested as well. In this picture, he's waking up. His memory is the sort of trauma of the exile on the right side of the page here, as he thinks about the his great-grandfather who was exiled from Jerusalem. The illustrations are clearly, you know, modern style, but modern comic book, evocative of an ancient world. They're, women are certainly more sensually drawn. The men are also more sensually drawn. There is no overt piety in the illustrations. On the contrary, they're seen as Persian men and women who sort of operate in the Persian Persian court, Persian system. Nothing that marks them as visually Jewish. And you see here, this is the scene where Haman is standing. Everyone's bowing down to him. And Mordechai has to tell everyone that he's Jewish because otherwise no one would know that he's Jewish. So he has to say, which is what the Pasuk essentially says, right? Ki higid lehem asher hu Yehudi. She said, I am Judean. That's why I don't bow down to people. The choices that are being made to illustrate a character like Mordechai make a very big difference in our impression of the characters. Right. So when you move to Perek Vav, which we'll spend a little bit more time with in the second part today, you have, again, here the Jews in the shul, they're all up all night davening, fasting, I suppose, although that's not visible. Esther is in the palace, also, like the light shining on her. She's davening. We saw that, you know, the Greek version of Esther is also davening. So that's not a new move. And in fact, I should say that in the back of Pollock's book, there are footnotes, which are essentially extensive quotations from Chazal, from Midrash, from the Gemara, and sometimes from the Rishonim, as to where he got each of the elements of his illustrations from. So lest you think that he's just freely interpreting, so no, I'm getting this from this Midrash, this from that Midrash, this is the Gemara over there, and so on. And then, of course, over here, you have Achashverosh, since this is Balel Ahudna, the Dashnat HaMelech, you have Achashverosh here, awake, and someone's reading to him. Sorry, I got cut off in the margin there. And at Haman's house, they're building the tree. Balayla Huna the Dashnat HaMelech. Well, this is how Waldman portrays it. So it was a little too graphic. I apologize if so. He's like having nightmares, a combination of monsters and sexuality, and everything is very tumultuous. I should say also that in the middle of Waldman's book, right at this moment, you actually have to turn the book over. Like the book starts from one direction, but then in the middle, and when you get to Perek Vav, the book literally turns 180 degrees. And the rest of the book then continues in the upside down direction to convey the sense that in Perek Vav, the entire Megillah turns upside down. So he's using art in a much more raw and creative way, I would say. And then this is the end in Waldman's Megillah. I wanted to emphasize that both Megillah, both of these books, I don't call them Megillah, both books have the full Hebrew text throughout with a translation. But whereas in Pollock, the text is sort of laid out in a fairly traditional way with the English alongside it. In Waldman, the text is integrated into the illustrations in all sorts of wild ways, and there's also other words as well. So that's the interpretive choices made by two illustrated Megillot. I think these are fascinating. I mean, both of them put a lot of depth into their pictures, and of course, these sort of encapsulate two very different views of how to read Megillat Esther. So for Waldman, you know, I don't know him. I met him once, but I don't know him well. But it seems like he was drawn to this because Megillat Esther seems to him to be the most secular book in Tanakh. And so the one where, you know, you can sort of go to town illustrating these people as Persians. I don't have to worry about like how to draw God, which you would have to do if you illustrated Bereshit, for example. and so drawn to it exactly because it's so different from the rest of Tanakh. For Pollock, well, this is in a series of books, actually. You know, he also has Pesach books, he has other Jewish books. And this is actually not different. And the way that he's reading Esther, of course, brings it in line with the rest of Tanakh and with the sort of traditional Jewish approaches to some of these questions. The key point here is that these are illustrative of two different approaches, but also that these are great. And if you have a chance before Purim to pick up one of these, maybe it's on your shelf, or maybe you have a chance to get one and just use them. They are fantastic, not only for kids, they're fantastic for adults as thought-provoking illustrations of the story of Esther. You know, you can like or dislike any of the details there, but the pictures are so rich and provocative that I think they do wonders for just thinking about the story and thinking about what's going on in the story and the meaning of it. Okay, so I'm going to pause there and then we will come into the second part here. I'm just looking at the chat to see very quickly. So people have some really excellent comments that I hope everyone else is reading as well. Oh, did I get the name wrong? Briginsky? Possible. Very nice. Okay, good. Good, fine. So hopefully everyone else will read those comments as well. I think they add to the discussion. Now, all right, second part today, and this will be the last thing we have time for. Let's move on. So is God present in the Megillah? So, of course, on the straightforward, literal, narrative level, the answer is no. God's never mentioned in the Megillah. We've already seen that that's true in the Hebrew version, but not true in the Greek version. We saw that in the additions to the Megillah that we have in Greek, where people are constantly invoking God. I didn't give you this example, but I should say that it's not only in the additions that God shows up in the Greek version of the Megillah. It's also in throughout the rest of the story, some of the psukim are rewritten to include God. So this one is particularly important, and this is the pasuk we're going to spend some time with. So it's the one that we just showed you in Waldman's and Pollock's illustrations. Balailahu hahu nadadash natamelech. On that night, the king's sleep was disturbed. Now, that is this Perek Vav, is clearly the turning point of the Megillah. It's clear, you know, lots of people have observed, and I think this is right, that the Megillah basically, everything up until Perek Vav is reversed after Perek Vav. There's all sorts of parallels between the beginning and the end, where things are now backwards. Of course, the Megillah gives us the language for that. And later on, when it says "v'nahafochu," "v'nahafochu" is clearly one good way of summarizing the structure of the book. Now, everything in the second half is reversed from the first half. The tightest contrast there is between the very end of Perek Hay and the very end of Perek Vav. In the very end of Perek Hay and the very end of Perek Vav, Haman goes back to his wife and his family and says, "Look, I have this problem with Mordechai." At the end of Perek Hay, Zeresh says, "No problem, go kill him. Like, what are you waiting for? Why do you let him bother you like this?" At the end of Perek Vav, she says, "Oh, im mizera yudim, right? If he's Jewish, lo tuchalo, kinafol tipolafana. Then you're not going to be able to defeat him." So Perek Vav has changed everything. What seemed like Haman was obviously on the upswing, was going to win at the end of Perek Hay, has changed dramatically by the end of Perek Vav. And then that sort of lays the groundwork for the rest of the story unraveling for Haman and the continuation of the book. So Perek Vav is the key. Perek Vav is where everything turns around. And that, of course, begins with the king not being able to sleep. So if you're going to see God in the Megillah, this is a good place to see God. The king can sleep. If the king can sleep that night, the whole story is different, right? And he never meets Haman. He never has the encounter with Haman and Mordechai and the horse and so on. I think it's worth saying literarily that actually that wouldn't matter that much. Meaning in terms of the actual plot, the fact that Haman gets to lead Mordechai around on a horse doesn't save anyone, doesn't help anyone. What really saves the Jews is that the next day, Esther's going to be at the banquet and she's going to tell the king that he needs to help her and her people. But we all understand emotionally that actually the fact that Haman had to give Mordechai the reward that he wanted for himself encapsulates the point that the entire Megillah is now turning. The whole story is now turning. So, Balayla Ahuna Dazashna Tamelech, the Greek has on that night, Balayla Ahu, and I translated it into Hebrew, Nideid Ha'adon Etshna Tamelech. Now, the Lord kept sleep from the king that night. So that's how it's translated in the Greek. It's possible, people have suggested, possible that the translators read it as rather than Nadidash Natamelech, Nun Dalad Dalad Hey, but read it as Nideid Hashem et Shnat HaMelech. There is no evidence that back in the 3rd century BCE, or even the 2nd century BCE, they were using Hey as a writing of God, but it could be short for something. In any event, the Greek does put God explicitly into this line. So rather than it just happens to be that that night the king couldn't sleep, instead explicitly, God kept sleep from the king that night. And the Midrash goes to town on this pasuk. They love this pasuk. So I'm going to give you just a series of Midrashim quickly. This whole sleep motif, the Midrash says, that didn't start here. That started back in Perek Gimel. When Haman said to Achashverosh, Yeshno Am Echad, literally just, there is a people, a nation. The Midrash says, what is he saying? Yeshno Am Echad? Yashen Lo Echad Mehem. This people's Echad is Yashen. This people's one, meaning God, is now asleep. Haman's like, now is the time to get him. Their God is asleep. So according to the Midrash, Haman said, I think God's asleep. Why would Haman think that God's asleep? Well, after all, the Jewish people are in exile, right? They're here, they're in Shushan, they're all over the place. God's clearly asleep on the job. He's not taking care of the Jewish people anymore. God got mad and said, what, you think I'm asleep? I don't sleep. In fact, I'm now going to use the lack of sleep to save my people. So let's move on to Perek Vav though. Lo ne'emar, the second source here. Lo ne'emar shenato shel Achashverosh. It doesn't say, balaluhu nadadash shenat Achashverosh, ela nadadash shenat hamelech. Okay, who else could the king be? Well, obviously. Shena shel melech malchei hamlachim akadosh baruch hu. Who was roused from their sleep that night? Not Achashverosh. It was God who couldn't sleep. Now, that's a pretty dramatic thing to say, because of course it seems to assume that normally God does sleep. So the Midrash immediately sort of catches itself. It says, wait. B'chiyeshe naba marom, does God ever sleep? Ela kishe Yisrael chot'im, kivyachol ose atzmo kiyashen. No, of course not. God doesn't sleep. But when Israel sins, God acts as if God sleeps. Shenamar ura lama tishan, as actually quite raw pasuk in Tehillim says, God, wake up. Why are you sleeping? But when Israel does what God wants, then the guardian of Israel doesn't sleep and does not slumber. So the key point here is that what does it mean, that God's self was unable to sleep that night? Again, not that God usually sleeps, but that God roused that night and said, okay, now I'm actually going to get going. And then one last source here from Chazal. Oh, in my typo, sorry. That should say Keta Targum Le'Esther Min HaGniza. So this is actually a Gniza fragment from the Cairo Gniza of a Targum, of an Aramaic translation of Esther. It says as follows, translating Perek Vav Pasuk Aleph, says, Bei Belayla. So that night, nobody's sleeping. That night, the sleep of the carpenters making the cross, the crucifix for Haman, their sleep was disturbed. Babylalia, Nedachna Ton de Napachaya, Lameavad Mikvaasuchei, Bitsliva. That night, the blacksmith's sleep was disturbed because they had to make the nails to put into that crucifix. Babylalia, Nedachna Ton de Malach, de Malch Malchaya. That night, the sleep of the King of Kings was disturbed. Elo Dichtiv, La Ifshar Lameimar. If it weren't written, I couldn't say it. Dichtiv ura lama tishan Hashem, vayukatz ki Hashem Hashem, beibelelia Hashem itgalei kudsha brichu. So the Targum here is really interesting because it wants to say that God was awake that night, but realizes, again, like the Midrash, just how radical it is to say that night God couldn't sleep. So it says, yeah, I know, but what am I supposed to do? Ila dichtiv laif shalom yomar. If it weren't written, I wouldn't say it. But hey, it's written explicitly. What can I do? I've got to say it. Of course, to be clear, it's not written explicitly, right? It doesn't say anywhere that God couldn't sleep that night. But the Midrash and the Targum were like, no, it's God who couldn't sleep that night. That's what we're seeing here in Perek Vav Pasuk Aleph. Bailaluhu Nadash Natamelach means that night, God finally stopped acting as if God were asleep and roused God's self from a slumber of sorts and started getting to work here. So that's why the wheels start to turn in Perek Vav. Suddenly everything's going to turn around because God's at work. Okay. Now that's on the one hand. So here we have sources that looked at Perek Vav and they're like, well, I mean, it doesn't say that God's at work, but like, obviously God's at work. I mean, that's what it's all about, right? It's obviously all about God. So, you know, God roused the king. God was the one who couldn't sleep, whatever it may be. But there are some commentators, and these are, of course, traditional commentators, who are like, actually, it's the king who couldn't sleep, and there's a good reason for him not to sleep. So I want to give you two. The second one is actually, I think, much more interesting, but I'll give you one first. This is Yosef ben Yosef Nachmias, who you see, 14th century. All of his works were published like 100 years ago by someone, I don't know, by Moshe Lev Bamberger. And his commentary on Esther, at least, is now incorporated also into alhatorah.org. So you can see it there. And you can see also that I skipped a little bit in the middle because he sort of changes his mind in the middle of his commentary. So I only gave you one of his versions. But Nachmias, who sort of building on a comment of Rava's in the Gemara in Megillah, says, you know what happened? Why couldn't Achashverosh sleep that night? Because Achashverosh had just come back from the banquet with Esther and Haman. And one of the things that bothered him was, Sam el libo inyan zimun Esther lehaman. He was wondering, why did Esther invite Haman? I know he's the Mishnah Lamelech, but like, so what? What kind of dinner is this? You know, is this a state dinner? Like, why is the Secretary of State there? Why is the Vizier here? If it's a romantic dinner, or just a family dinner, then I don't understand why Haman's there. And you know, I got there and I asked her what she wanted, and she didn't even want anything. She just wanted me to come back again with Haman, though. So, like, what is going on with this? So Achashverosh was just troubled. Why is Haman being invited to this banquet? Now, that's more or less what Rava says in the Gemara. And here Nachmias then builds on this and says, and why did he call in for the book? Binyan havaat sefer zichronot shechashav she'im haya emet atzat Haman v'ester she'i afshar shelo yiyah be'avadav. Says, okay, well, what if there is a plot? Maybe there's a plot. There, look, you know, I am a Persian king. There's always plots to assassinate me. This is what happens. You know, Big Tan and Teresh were in the Megillah. Like, there's always plots. But how do I escape those plots? Because even if there's a plot, other people are loyal to me. So Achashverosh is thinking, okay, it's possible that Haman and Esther are plotting something. I don't know. But if so, someone else will uncover it and they will let me know. But then he thought, Shuv Chashav, Shema Gmalani Adam Tova V'lo Gmal Tiv Kahena. But he thought, well, I don't know, but maybe not. What if I've actually offended like my whole court somehow? What if I've offended all the people who normally would protect me? How would I do that? Maybe they've done good for me and I haven't paid them back. Miyad V'yomer Lahavi at Sefer HaZichronot. So he said, go bring Sefer HaZichronot. Go bring the Sefer HaZichronot. And sort of implicit in what Nachmiah says here, is that he didn't just say open randomly and read me stories. He specifically said, go find stories where people help me out. maybe specifically go find stories where people save me from assassination plots. And they, so they're looking through and they're like, oh, yes, Mordecai saved you from the assassination plot of Bigthan and Teresh. It's good, good, good. What did I do to reward him? Nothing. Nothing? Oh, this is like his worst fear, right? Like, he's specifically worried, according to Nachmias, that he's lost the loyalty of his court by not treating people well. So here he says, go find cases where people help me, see what I did for them, and he's find the first case, and he didn't help them. The details are interesting, but I actually want to focus not on the specific details, but on the basic, more basic point here, that according to Nachmias, nothing about this is all that surprising. You don't need God involved here. Ahasuerus is not sleeping because he is legitimately worried about something that just happened during that day. And he's worried about something that's going to happen tomorrow. It's not a coincidence that he happened to read the story of Mordechai in the Sefer Zechronot. That's exactly what he was looking for. He was looking for a story of where someone had helped him and he had not paid them back. So God's not involved in the story. Not that Nachmias thinks that God's not involved in the Gilad Esther, but God's not involved in Perek Vav Pasuk Aleph. This all makes good sense. Like, there's perfectly good narrative logic for why Ahasuerush can't sleep, why he calls for the Sefer HaZichronot to be read, and why they read to him the story of Mordechai. An even more interesting example of this, more developed, comes from the commentary called Yosef Lekach by a commentator named Eliyahu ben Eliyahu Ashkenazi Harofei. From the 16th century. And I will show it to you, but I'm not going to read it to you. You'll see why. That's his comment on Perek Vav Pasuk Aleph. And he develops the following. He says, this is what's going on. Think about what just happened yesterday, like that morning, right? That morning, Ahasuerus is sitting on his throne as he usually does. Now, he knows the rules. The rules are no one's allowed to walk in without being called. In walks Esther. Whoa. Now, it's true, Ahasuerus extended his Sharvita Zahav, saved Esther. Okay, fine. But in walks Esther. She's literally risking her life to come to the throne room. There must be something very important that she wants to ask, which is why Ahasuerus said, what do you want, Esther? Like, what, you know, there must be something really important. And what did Esther say? Come to the Mishteh. And Ahasuerus is like, okay. According to Eliyahu Ashkenazi, Ahasuerus is not an idiot. He's like, okay, there must be something really important if Esther risked her life to invite me to a banquet with Haman. Clearly, there's some like big ask that she wants to make of him. So he comes and he says, okay, Esther, like, what do you need? And she says, tomorrow I will ask you. And he's like, oh my God, like, what could be such a huge thing that she's not? She risked her life, not the first banquet, second banquet. She's finally going to ask something like incredibly momentous. But actually, what could she be asking for? She is already the queen. I literally offered her Ad Chatzi Al Malchut, and she didn't take that. So what could she be asking for? Maybe it's not for herself. Like, maybe there's something else that she's someone else on whose behalf she's going to ask. So he's like, okay, well, what do I know about Esther? Like, who might she know? Who would she ask on behalf of? So he racks his brain and he remembers that 5 years earlier or so, she had come and revealed to him the plot of Bigthan and Teresh to assassinate him, b'shem Mordechai, in the name of Mordechai. Now he's like, oh, wait, so that's the one that she knows. You know, I know she communicates with this guy, Mordechai. I've met him. I don't know. He's sitting out there at the gate. So maybe she wants to ask something on behalf of Mordechai. Okay, I really need to do my research about Mordechai then. Because tomorrow, Esther is going to come in and have some huge request on behalf of Mordechai. What do I know about Mordechai? I need to know where I stand vis-a-vis Mordechai. So call in the Sefer HaZichronot. Right? Call in that the scribe to read the book. And do a search for anything about Mordechai. What do I know about Mordechai? What has he done for me? What have I done for him? Like, do I like him or not? So tomorrow I could be prepared. They start flipping through. They find the entry on Mordechai. They say, Mordechai saved your life. And she's like, I remember that. What did I do for him? Nothing. Nothing. And so on. Now, again, what I think is really fascinating here is that both of these commentators, Yosef Nachmias and Eliezer Harofei, are both thinking in entirely non-miraculous ways as to why the events of Perek Vav happen exactly the way they do. Like, there's a reason why Achashverosh can't sleep. They call in Sefer Zichronot, they read about Mordechai, and he wants to reward Mordechai. That makes good sense according to these commentators, because that is exactly what Achashverosh is troubled by. He's thinking about something, you know, are my servants going to be loyal to me? What do I know about Mordechai? So these commentators are not seeing God in the cracks here. Right? The sense that, like, well, it's too good to be true. Like, how could it be that just that night the king can't sleep and they happen to read a story about Mordechai? That's just too coincidental. According to Nachmias and Ashkenazi, not so coincidental. It actually makes perfectly good sense. There's no gap here in which you need to see God because the story coheres really, really well. So, again, I'm not arguing that they're right and the others are wrong. What I'm really trying to argue is that, like, people see the story in such different ways. It's actually astonishing. Where some people are like, this is obviously the hand of God. Other people say, like, no, that makes perfectly good sense. There's actually no question here. Of course, Achashverosh can't sleep and called in the Sefer Zichronot to read about Mordechai. Now, in modern commentators, we have sort of similar divide. We have a similar divide. So, you know, what do modern scholars think about the presence or absence of God in Esther? So I picked up this book once on the in the Yeshiva University library on the shelf. The Message of Esther. Oh, that's interesting. So what is the Message of Esther? So literally didn't have to get past the title page. The Message of Esther is God present but unseen, according to David Firth, which, you know, I think Chazal would pretty much like. Anochi Haster Esther Panai Mehem. So according to some modern readers, and the Message of Esther is exactly that God is present, but behind the scenes. Other scholars look at this and they're like, actually, this is, I think, an amazing insight, no matter what you think about Esther. Richard Elliot Friedman, who's a prominent biblical scholar, wrote a book called The Disappearance of God, where he makes the point that if you read Tanakh in the Jewish order, which you might know is very different from the Christian order, if you read it in the Jewish order, beginning to end, so you start at Bereishit, you go through the Torah, go through Nevi'im Rishonim, Nevi'im Achronim, and Ketuvim. Then over the course of that reading, God will progressively disappear. God is so central at the beginning, but although we keep referring to the Exodus, in fact, the Exodus was, in a sense, the high watermark. The last person to whom God reveals God's self is Shmuel. That's Nigle, like the Shorish Nigle. The last person to whom God appears, Nirah, is Shlomo. The last public miracle in Tanakh is Eliyahu and Har HaKarmel. And the last personal miracle is for Chizkiyahu. Now, there are some things that happen in Sefer Daniel, for example, but those are always with angels. God doesn't actually appear in Sefer Daniel. And importantly for Friedman, it's not surprising then that when you get to the end of Tanakh, you get to Sefer Esther, Megillat Esther, and God is absent entirely. Like, actually, if we've been reading straight through, according to Friedman, we're not surprised. Like, God has just been progressively reducing God's presence in the world over the course of Tanakh. So by the end, God's not in the story. Now, again, it's not totally linear. You know, you have to balance that out with, let's say, Ezra, where you have things that are not God involved directly, but God awakens the spirit of Koresh. That's something far less direct than what you might have in Siyam Mitzrayim, but it's still something. And something like Daniel, where the angel appears to save Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah in Kivshana Ish, or the angel tells Daniel all sorts of things. So it's not just a straight downward slope. It gets complicated at the end. And actually, a lot of books are really quite interesting to think of in this regard. Think about Ruth, for example. In Ruth, God doesn't do anything, but the characters are always talking about God. The only thing that God is said to do, the only verb that God is actually the subject of in Megillat Ruth, is impregnating Ruth. But that's right after saying that Boaz slept with her. So Boaz slept with her and God made Ruth pregnant is, again, like, not very miraculous on God's part. So, you know, Ruth's another case where God is not absent in the sense that that God's absent in Esther. Like, people talk about God all the time, but it's certainly very different from Sefer Shemot, where God actually does things. So there's lots of books that are I think, really interesting to think about in the question of presence or absence of God. But for Friedman, God is not just accidentally absent. This is actually the climax of Tanakh. For Friedman, the whole point of Tanakh has been to get Bnei Israel to realize that they can live without God. Not that there is no God. I don't know what Friedman actually thinks personally. But not that there is no God, but that life doesn't involve God. Real life, you can't sit around waiting for an exodus to happen. And so, yeah, that's back in the early days, right? God walks with people, talks to them, meets them on corners, things like that. Doesn't happen anymore. And in the life that we now know, of which Esther is the climax, God is entirely absent. So that's Friedman's reading. Yoram Chazoni, some of you may have read either his first version, The Dawn, which is like this sort of underground published book that was really quite brilliant and influential. And he redid it a few years ago, called God and Politics in Esther. For Chazoni, the book is all about Machiavellian politics, right? There are no coincidences. Like Mordechai and Esther are like incredibly shrewd statespeople, statesmen and stateswoman, orchestrating everything in a quite brilliant and cynical political way. But according to Chazoni, that's really just the first step. Maybe I should have included a quote, but that's really the first step towards seeing God in the world. So for Chazoni, like, it's all about God. It's all about how politics work in the name of God. And then one last modern scholar, Michael Fox, a book called Character and Ideology in the Book of Esther. He says, well, the whole point is actually that it's an open question. Is God present or absent in the book? Yeah, that's a really good question. It's hard to say, right? I mean, it's easy to see God in the gaps here. It's also easy to say that God's not in the gaps here. And that's kind of the point, because the author, according to Fox, was sincerely unsure whether God was operating in Jewish history in the exile, in Galut. So the author is sitting there in Galut Bavel wondering, like, I don't know, like, this is clearly not like the Exodus. You know, it's clearly not like Yetziat Mitzrayim, clearly not like David and Shlomo and Yerushalayim. But does that mean that God is behind the scenes? Or does it mean that God is absent entirely? And the author doesn't know. So the author writes a story in which it's very clearly conveyed that it's unclear whether God is present or absent. Present but hidden, absent but acting, all sorts of possibilities. But for Fox, that open-endedness of the discussion, sort of a meta comment on this whole discussion, is an expression of the author's uncertainty as to what to do with the theology of his own time. Like, I don't know. I don't know if God's here or not. I sometimes think I catch a glimpse of God, but at the same time, like, there's no smoking gun. Like, God hasn't shown up and talked to me. So I don't know. I don't know if this is God or not. And so he writes a story in which you could see God, but maybe you don't see God. And it's a, you know, here today, gone tomorrow, but maybe gone today, here tomorrow. And there's just no way of answering that question, because that's reflective of the uncertainty of living in an exile, where God's presence is actually at best uncertain. Yeah. All right. So let me just open the chat one last time, and then we'll wrap up. Right. So, okay. I'm sorry for everyone else can read the chat, as well. Yeah. Maybe I should have commented on this. So the, you know, we have this word, this is really a side point, but we have this word in the Megillah, Tala, right? That Haman is going to be Tole Mordechai, and then Haman is, Nitle, Taf Lamed Hey. And, modern scholars think that probably means impalement, because that's what the Persians did. It's kind of gruesome to think about. I don't know if it's more gruesome than hanging. Anyway, it's gruesome. We don't have evidence for hanging in the sense, you know, noose around the neck, from Mesopotamia or Persia in ancient times. But it's true. The Targum assumes that it's crucifixion because that's what they're familiar with, right? So the Romans crucify people all the time, unfortunately. So they take tala to mean, you know, they translate it as tzadi lamed bet, to crucify. And and you know, somehow I guess later on people assumed that meant hanging, like with a noose around the neck. And many modern scholars and historians think it probably meant impalement. So I don't know if it matters that much, other than for just accuracy in translation and understanding. But it's true that the crucifixion that the Targum was referring to is sort of an imposition from Roman times back on Persian times. Okay, yeah, so great Great comments also about the angels. Okay, very nice. So I'm going to end with just one last sentence, which I think summarizes the way I think about this. So as you can see, there's a lot of different interpretations of Esther, and it's sometimes kind of frustrating to me, honestly, because I like having a sense of what a text actually means. Now, maybe it's particularly appropriate for Purim to be loose, to like not have a sense of what the text actually means, have no solid ground on which to stand. And so, you know, everyone essentially sees in the Megillah something that, you know, tends to confirm what they believed anyway, or in any event, says something that they like to hear. Maybe that's good. Maybe that's exactly what we need on Purim. But it reminds me of this line. I apologize. It's I guess PG-13. But it's from the Gemara, so it's not my fault. So Gemara in Megillah says, Amar Rav, about Esther, Bikesh li tom ta'am betula ta'am, ta'am be'ula ta'am. Why did Achashverosh love Esther so much? Well, because when he slept with her, when he wanted to taste the flavor of an experienced woman, he tasted that. When he wanted to taste the flavor of a virgin, he tasted that. In other words, she was remarkably talented at giving him whatever flavor he wanted that night. And this line always pops into my head when I see the dizzying array of interpretations of Megillat Esther. It's almost as if, like, as she was, so is her book. Like, the book gives you a book that you like. You know, what do you want to see in the book? The book is there for you. Is it a Zionist book? It's a Zionist book. Is it an atheist book? It's an atheist book. Is it a Zionist atheist book? It's a Zionist atheist book. Is it a religious book? Sure, it's a religious book. Is it a comic book? Absolutely, it could be a comic book. Politically shrewd? Sure. Is it just like Yitzhak Mitzrayim? Absolutely. Is it the opposite of Yitzhak Mitzrayim? Sure, also that. Bikesh l'tom ta'am betula ta'am. Ta'am be'ula ta'am. Whatever you see, whatever someone comes to Esther asking to see, they somehow find that in Megillat Esther. I'm not going to say that this makes me happy. Again, as someone who works with text, I like to have a sense of like solid ground under my feet. Like, you know, let's try to establish like at least some sense of like where we're standing, our hermeneutic position, so we can have a sense of like what is and what is not an acceptable interpretation here. But Esther seems to just confound those expectations and those aspirations. And the array of ways in which people have read the Megillah and continue to read the Megillah is actually astonishing and inspiring. So, you know, my book about Esther came out, I guess, in 2014. So it's been almost a decade. I haven't, you know, whenever I would go talk about Esther or teach something about Esther, I'd say, like, you know, here's my brilliant, innovative interpretation of whatever. And, you know, all the comments and questions, we're not like, oh, that is indeed a brilliant and innovative interpretation, whatever. Instead, they were like, well, here's how I read Esther. And at first I was like, hey, but you know, you're not listening to me. But I came to realize, like, actually, this is what's amazing about Esther in particular, but actually a lot of our classic texts. Like, it's not that they weren't listening. They're happy to get another interpretation. But like, that's just adding on. Like, here's what I think about it. Here's what I think about it. I've learned so much from those conversations where people say, like, you know, that's really interesting what you just said. Here's my interpretation. And it's fantastic. The interpretations keep coming. So I, you know, as I know many of you know, it takes years to write a book, right? So I lived with Esther for like 5 years. You know, immediately afterwards, I was like, Esther and I are seeing other people. Like, we are not spending any more time together. It's been a very long time. But actually, one of the things that makes it so interesting and gratifying to come back to Esther is that there's always someone who says, like, well, actually, here's my insight. And it's a whole different way of reading something. It opens up whole new vistas on the Megillah. Whether they were what the author meant or not, that's a harder question. But that they are tastes of Esther that enhance our appreciation and enhance our Purim, absolutely. So I hope that something in the last 6 weeks you'll take to your Purim. And overall, it's been a really enjoyable 6 weeks I got to spend with you. Let me close this up. If anyone has any last comments or questions, not like meta comments, like this was fun or this was not fun, especially this is not fun part. I don't want to hear that. But if you have specific comments, you know, now's your last chance, and then we'll have to wrap this up. Anyone else? Okay, you can also put them in the chat. Naomi?
First of all, thank you very much. This has been wonderful. But I guess one of the things that I'm ending with is that sometimes in Esther, as in the text in general, the ambiguity is part of the point.
Yeah, it may well be. It may well be. I mean, sometimes I feel like that's a cop-out, but in this case, I think it's probably not. I think that's probably by design. That's exactly right. Exactly right.
Yeah, and there's much to learn from it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, wonderful. No, that's, I can't think of a better way of ending than that. So thank you. All right. I don't know the announcements that we're supposed to make. There's another class in 28 minutes or something by Rachel Danziger Sharansky. Sharansky Danziger. It was great. And I'm going to leave the Zoom open for those who are staying on, but I am departing. So I wish you all Purim Sameach. I really enjoyed the time together, and hopefully we will learn again together soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Purim Sameach.
Thank you.
Purim Sameach.
Are you thinking anywhere else that we can Zoom in, so to speak?
I mean, I'm here in my attic.
We'll Thank follow you.
I hang out here like 18 hours a day, you know.
But now you're in trouble. We're have Esther for 5 years, and now you're going to have all of us for the rest of the time.
That's it. Yeah, we'll follow. Yeah.
You actually talk back. No, the text does also. It's, yeah, it's good.
It does.
All righty.
Okay, bye-bye, thank you. It was so wonderful. Thank you.
Really,
thank
you.
Really, I love the Tom analogy. Oh my God, now I have to think about it. There was one Shakespearean character who kept saying, why is this stuff in my head now? Why is this stuff in my head now? And now I'm thinking about the Tom Bosick. Oh my God, now why is this in my head?
Excellent.
It's great. It's great.
That's great.
Thank
All
you.
Right. Yeah. Excellent. All right, bye everyone.
Aaron, can I ask you a question?
Yes, absolutely.
Hi. So I wish you hadn't put that Rav quote in there.
But it pops into my head all the time. I have to put it.
So is he being satirical, or is that how he sees Esther? Does he see Esther that way? Ew, yeah.
I think it's likely that, yeah, that he means that. Yeah, I don't know if he means it literally, but he means that she was talented at pleasing Ahasuerus in bed. I think that's pretty clear. You know, whether
right, which flies in the face of the other version of Esther as being so sweet and innocent.
Right, right. Well, remember, I mean, okay, so
and better. Where did she learn all that?
Yeah, exactly. well, you know, especially when we tell it for kids, it's always like, oh, it was a beauty contest. It's not a beauty contest. Remember, you have to be beautiful to get into the contest. It's a sex contest. It's like the beautiful women get called and they each get one night with the king, and then he'll decide if he wants you back. So it's not, I mean, Rob's not making that up. Like, it's actually all about that.
Yeah.
You know, if you were like Sherazada and told him stories all night, you know, you probably wouldn't, you might've been alive. You probably wouldn't have gotten called back the next day. Like it's
right.
Pretty clear what the, you know, how to win this game. Interesting question, actually. So I don't want to think about it.
But anyway. It does
contradict. All right.
Thank you so much for that.
I guess I'm
does sort of contradict that. That's the Karkaola
time, not 4:30 Israel time now. Did the time switch?
Sorry, that's a well. There's a, you know, two views in the Rishonim as to what to make of that lie.
Right.
So one of them is exactly right. Like she's, you know, remain passive. The other is that in legal terms, a woman is by definition passive in sex. That since she can't rape him, it doesn't matter how
it's acquired.
Exactly. Like she is legally speaking passive no matter what. So in other words, according to that, forbidden sexual relationships are never yehar regval yavor for a woman, because they are by definition passive in that relationship, or at least not. Yeah. I mean, that's the extreme way of,
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. Anyway. Like, is someone staying on? Cause I'm supposed to leave, but not close it. So I need to make someone else the host of this. Who's staying on for Rachel Danziger? All right, I'm going to assume that some of you are. Okay.
I'm staying on.
Oh, okay, wonderful. So you are now the host. Enjoy.